Welcome, one and all, to another installment of Tales from the Forlorn Dopes. Appreciate everyone stopping by. I am your host, Cyber Smiley.
I am your co-host, Wisdom. And I am very glad to see you all again. Greetings, programs. Tonight we have a review of Land of the Free.
Yes. That we do.
We got something talk about briefly before we jump into it, but yeah,
I'm sure we have a few things. So you want to go first?
I'll just briefly mention that I recently heard a rumor that NASA dropped some kind of a campaign where somebody steals the Hubble telescope. I haven't been able to track it down yet or anything, but that's kind of neat. I'm sure it's for Dungeons and Dragons or something like that, but that would be pretty easy to drop right over.
Someone stole the Hubble telescope?
No, it's a campaign that NASA released.
Oh.
Yeah. I've been trying to track down any information on that, but that sounds really cool to me.
Oh, I have not heard of this.
That's about as much information as I had, is that apparently it exists. But, or it's going to exist. I'm not really sure if it's out yet or not. Oh, no, it does. It's called The Lost Universe. On NASA's science.gov page.
Yeah, huh. Yeah, and just found the Forbes article about that. Look at that. The geeks are finally coming out in NASA.
I mean, it doesn't really get any geekier than that, really. Like that's the nerd geek combo that, you know, may foreshadow the end of times.
Interesting. Huh. I did not realize that. So, granted, it's not necessarily cyberpunk. It would have been nice. It would have made more sense if it was cyberpunk.
I mean, it's apparently easily adaptable to your preferred tabletop game, so I don't know that it has any base system of its own.
It's an adaptable... Interesting. What would happen if the telescope disappeared? The lost universe unfolds. Huh. Yeah, it basically says any system, whether Savage World, Fate Core, GURPS, or something else. Interesting. Or Shadow Scar, right?
Yeah.
That's cool. The other big news, I think, from last time we talked was Apple announced that they are going forward, that they've bought 10 episodes of Neuromancer.
I will never count my chickens before they're hatched when it comes to Neuromancer, but this is the most promising. This is the furthest along that project has ever gotten.
Yes.
So it might be real and it might come out. I'm not going to try and I'm hoping not to jinx anything, but yeah, I'm very excited with this news. Already told my friend who's got Apple TV, cause I don't support that company, but, that I'm going to be camping at his house for it.
Yeah. So, Graham Rowland, who is accredited to Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan and Dark Wind series, is going to be the showrunner. So,
I don't know anything about Dark Winds, but the Jack Ryan series was fantastic.
Yeah, and also Gibson is one of the executive producers, so that's nice.
All right, well, keep that crotchety old man involved.
Yeah, and speaking of his other show, Peripheral, was canceled during the strike. So we are not going to get a second season of that.
Yeah.
Which sucks.
Yeah, that's heartbreaking. I really liked that show.
I did too. In other news, I saw a preview that Robert Barefoot dropped on Tales of the Red, Forlorn Hope. A 6-mission campaign.
Yeah. Sequel to the original. And Will Moss is coming back and writing the opening, like, introductory fiction.
That's cool.
That's very cool. Yeah. It's good to see the any members of the old crew coming in to work on Red.
Most definitely. Gives it some creds that us old grogners are still... still part of the genre to help mold it. Help guide the younger generation, the new generation, into the wonderful world of cyberpunk. So that's... I haven't heard too much else in other news around cyberpunk genre. Or anything from... about Red.
No, it's been a pretty slow 2 weeks.
Yeah, I gotta hit up Mr. Barefoot to try to get some of the RTG guys back on. But we do have a guest we are hoping will join us next episode. But he is a busy man. Hopefully, we'll get him. But there are other
again.
People.
We're not gonna name names because we don't want to jinx it. But yeah, he's somebody we've been trying to get on for a long time.
Yeah, so still trying to track down other people who I would like to talk to, but apparently they're not taking my emails.
And sad to say, we still have no credible leads on Doug Anderson. Like, we have looked everywhere.
So
anybody out there knows how to get in touch with him, let us know.
So I did send an email to a possible hit. I have not received a reply. And again, with emails, it's kind of difficult because how junk mail algorithms work. There's always a chance that you think you sent an email, but maybe it got through.
They may get it as spam. They may look at it and be like, well, I don't recognize. Well, what the hell do I want to talk to them to?
Boy. Yeah.
There could be lots of things. But, it's weird that a guy who was such a prolific cover artist is hard to track down.
Yeah, and I saw on Reddit a thread about 2 years ago asking whatever happened to Doug, and Mike actually... added to the conversation, saying, "Yeah, if anyone knows where he is, R. Talsorian and CDPR is looking for looking to work.
Would love to have him come in and maybe contribute stuff.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's hard to track down somebody, especially if you don't know where they're originally from. Because you can't track down people. It's just you need more than just a name.
Yeah. And, we've exhausted all the, like, normal avenues of trying to track him down through, Drive-Thru RPG or Board Game Geek or any of those. Like, the information they provide is just really, really sparse.
Well, the other problem was another Doug Anderson. Artist and game designer.
it creates a bit of confusion.
I did talk to that Doug. He's like, yep, I get this a lot, but I'm not him. Like, damn.
Like, you want to fake it just to be on the show?
Yeah.
No, we're looking for him. There are other people we're looking for, but he's the name that gets requested the most. So yeah, we're not giving up. Beyond that, no, like you said, or like we said, news on new products is kind of sparse right now.
Actually, with Cyberpunk 2077, another patch drop, but it's mostly bug fixes.
Yeah, it didn't drop any like fun toys or anything. It was just bug fixes,
and they were small bugs. So.
Yeah, the only content that's still getting put out is like their part through CDPR's partnership with Amazon Prime. They put out like a new gun a month that you can either download or wait for it to pop up in one of the loot boxes.
Huh, really?
Yeah, I think there's been like six of them so far.
I also noticed that a couple weeks ago, someone sent out some concept art that they attributed to Cyberpunk 2077 Orion. Whether it's true or not, don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I saw that, and some of it was really nice looking, but it's really early for them to be throwing anything like that out, and I don't know, I take all that information with a grain of salt, especially with all the AI bullshit going on.
Mm. Yeah, exactly.
It's sad that you have to look at any piece of art that you weren't previously familiar with, or that you don't like know the artist, as being kind of suspect.
Yeah, and that's a shame.
Yeah.
But if it's true, then I guess APCs are coming in for Project Orion.
Nice.
At least that's some of the art that I saw.
If it's true, then they're further along than I thought, so that's awesome.
I mean, ACPAs, not ACPs, or APAs.
Yeah, whatever. I thought that's what you meant. Like acronyms. Power armor. Yeah. That would be cool. I'm really hoping for some Appleseed type landmates, but that's me.
Eventually. All right. So I guess we can get into it, because I think this is going to be a two-parter, just because of the extent of this. So
Land of the Free is a huge campaign. It's just to give everybody out there the gist, it's a cross-country campaign going from New York to California, and it follows Murphy's Law, where if anything can go wrong, it'll go wrong at any given moment.
Yep.
I don't run a lot of pre-generated campaigns. I've run this one a couple of times.
I tried starting it. Many of my campaigns, it's usually the group that falls apart due to whatever reason.
That definitely happens.
But yes.
But this one, like, it's got something for everybody. It's written by Will Moss. It's got a fantastic with contributions by Michael McDonald and Lisa Pondsmith. It's got phenomenal interior art. Chris Hockabout, Christina Wald, Daryl Midgets, Jean Michael Ringway. I want to say that's how you pronounce that. Jean-Michel Ringway? I don't know. Patrick Godaro. This has one of my favorite individual images by Chris. Graphics and layout, David Ackerman, Benjamin Wright, Michael McDonald, and Mark Schumann. I mean, and playtesting, like literally everybody who was anybody got involved in the playtesting for this. Like Benjamin Wright, Craig Sheely, Spike Wynn, Eric Hester, Aaron Marlin,
Robert Chen,
Gary Rieger, Cindy Foster, Jeff Harrell, like just a ton of the like old hats worked on this. Derek Quintanar was involved in the editing. And of course, the gorgeous cover by the aforementioned Doug Anderson.
Yep.
Which the cover for this bookends with the cover for Home of the Brave. And it's just gorgeous.
Yeah, it would have been nice.
It really bugged me that they never just released that as a poster.
Yeah, I was about to say. Like some type of print.
Well.
But I don't think back in the day there's too many gaming companies that were doing prints, right? It was the individual artists who did them.
Yeah, and you know, I've said it before, I'll say it again. It was really weird that there were never any like promotional posters for any of the. I've never seen a promotional poster for any of the Cyberpunk 2020 stuff. I remember seeing one for Mechton in a gaming store, but I've never seen a single one for any Arthouse Orion Cyberpunk product. I always thought that was kind of bizarre.
Well, keep in mind that, you know, they were pretty small compared to some of the bigger companies. Like, you know, like Faz had a crap load of money. I mean, the big ones were FASA, TSR.
No, sure, I get that. I just...
like West End Games
had... It just always struck me as weird.
Had Star Wars, so that kind of... That was just... They printed their money.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, well, you know, again, all depends on budget. I'd rather have them pay their authors for quality stuff, which...
I would too. It just, like, back in the day, you would see posters at, like, give-outs at conventions or, you know, just promotional material sent to the gaming stores and whatnot. It just always struck me as odd that Arthouse Orion didn't really ever get involved in that. Yep. On the other hand, it's kind of a lifesaver because I can only imagine what a poster would be going for now.
I'm sure you would have them all.
I mean, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
So, let's get into it. This was originally a box set. Now, I think it is basically a print-on-demand from DriveThruRPG.
If you can get the box set, get the box set. Just because the props for this game... We'll talk about them later, but the props are awesome. And the map itself, like it has a huge map of America that...
That's what's worth the money.
Yeah, it's worth the money to get it. Yeah, if you can track down an original box set of this, by all means do it. If not, and you're doing the print-on-demand stuff, see if you can... pay to get a nice poster-sized version of that map.
Right. So, the first chapter of the book is basically an overview of the campaign, so there's a bit of a brief understanding of what the different chapters are going to be, just so you have an introductory, and then it gets into... kind of like how to run the campaign. The one thing that's great is, I think this is the first product. I don't remember if Listen Up Primitive Screwheads came out before this. But it kind of addressed the outstanding issue within Cyberpunk was the power levels, right? How do you structure a encounter for the group?
Yeah.
And this first chapter actually gets into that. You have the various different power levels of an NPC, which, you know, they put in levels of, like, you know, average person, minor hero, or villain,
and
major villain.
And they're differentiated by, you know, how many character points they have. how many career skill points and how many pickup skill points. Like that's what makes the difference between these character or NPC levels and that, and of course, you know, whatever gear you give them. But, like it was in fact this section here where it talks about these power levels that implemented me to do that with Interlock Unlimited and how many, you know, points to give stat-wise for characters and skill-wise for beginning characters and all that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you're right. I think this is the first time this appears in any of the official products.
Yep. And then it talks about what he's calling the character party strength, which is basically the number of players that there are. And then throughout the various chapters, you're going to see this a lot, in which they say, oh, you want 2x the CPS, right? So basically you want double the number of opponents to the players, or two more.
Or level them up. Yeah. Scale them up a little higher.
Exactly.
And it talks about doing the same thing with skill checks and scaling them. With what's going on and where the characters are at, as far as experience wise, it really, I mean, it does this for like, this goes on for basically 3 pages where it's just before it even starts talking about the game itself, it tells you, you know, as a GM, how to run it, how to keep it balanced, how to keep it challenging. And how to cater to, you know, the various archetypes that are going to make up your party.
Right. And in the beginning, in the foreword, you know, William Moss does specify that, hey, this is a game, you're here to have fun. So if the players are finding stuff too challenging, scale it back. You know, if they need to have a number fudge, do it. The other thing you're going to find in this adventure, which I know is a kind of a hot topic when it comes to running games, is this does have a bit of a railroading aspect to it. Just because, you know, you're talking about a whole country and all the various options that are laid out to the players and what they could possibly come up with. You can't. can't judge it or deal with all of
it. Yeah, it's a cross-country campaign where at various times, very specific things must happen in order for the campaign to continue. I mean, if your players are really opposed to doing the railroad or to being railroaded at all under any circumstances, it even tells you at the start, they can just jump on, they can figure out a way to get from one place to the other. And just bypass the whole adventure. Yay, game's over. Like that's. But if you play the adventure as it's meant to be played, everybody's going to have a good time.
Correct. And there is a warning that if the players do go off script, you will have to do quite a bit of re-engineering of the various encounters to try to make it fit.
Now. Yeah, go ahead.
But so that's going to take a bit of time and preparation, which you might not be able to ad lib, right, or improv through. So just keep that in mind.
Yeah. Now, luckily, most of those very specific has to happen here, has to happen at this point moments in the campaign, those are actually fairly rare. And most of the stuff you find, you can kind of fiddle with and move it around as to, you know, shave off the serial number, put it in a different place. Like, there's still plenty of room to wiggle. It is a tabletop role-playing game. It is cyberpunk. So there's still plenty of freedom. It's just certain things are going to happen when they happen. Yep. And your players are either going to be able to react to that or not.
Exactly. And then the overview or the introductory finally gets into the background of the campaign, which is spoiler about a cloning. And kind of gets into what is the current level of cloning, what are the laws around it, perceptions, and basically you are saving the first full human prototype, and it's called a Stage 7 clone,
Yeah.
which is kind of the miracle of the ages.
Yeah, I mean this campaign definitely has the potential to jump up the tech level in your game, at least as far as biotech is concerned. The ability to create viable autonomous clones is a major leap forward from the general tech level of the game before that. I'm going to go into that a bit later as to, possible ramifications of that, especially in regards to some of the other tech present in the game. But yeah, it's like cloning. You got to remember, this book came out in the early 90s, and cloning was still scary and brand new. I don't think Dolly had even been born yet. The cloned sheep that everybody freaked out about.
Yeah, I think Dolly was around that time.
If, yeah, possibly. Like it Dolly may have been in fact the inspiration behind this. But it was at that time, like when all that shit was brand new.
Dolly was, this
Bioengineering
was 2 years
really.
before Dolly.
It was 2 years
96.
before Dolly?
Yeah, 96. This book came out in
Okay.
94.
Well, yeah, there you go. So yeah, the idea of looking at these aspects of cloning from, a moral and ethical point of view, from a legal point of view, from, ramifications on society, like that shit really hadn't been tackled yet. Like as part of the national discourse, like it had shown up in some sci-fi, but it wasn't like a common theme at the time. Like with many of the concepts found in the cyberpunk franchise, it was ahead of its time. And the book really, really delves into those aspects of it. Beyond just the surface level adventure, there are these deeper concepts that you need to think about.
Yep. And then the final part of the introduction is what happens if they go off track from what you expect to do. And it also gets into reasons why they shouldn't, why player characters shouldn't be able to do certain ways of traveling, getting from New York to Night City. And it kind of delves into those concepts. Which is nice as opposed to some GMs who will just, wave it off and says, "Yeah, you can't." But I want to. No, you can't. Well, how, when can I? Because I said so, right?
Yeah, it's not the 2 foot tall barrier that you can't step over. It tries to give you reasons for this stuff and valid arguments to keep things moving as they are.
So, let's dive into the first segment, as they say. So each seg,
Before we do
yep,
that.
good.
In the, just to mention that in this chapter, there's also a timeline of cloning technology, starting in the year 2004, and up to 2020 when the adventure takes place. It gives you the definitions of each of the 7 stages of cloning, as well as an introduction to one of the main characters. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt all that. I just didn't want to skip over it either.
Yep, that's fine. I'm just checking to see if step one gene cloning. Yeah, looks like Mr. Moss did some research on the different seven levels.
He really did.
And I think that's one of the things I kind of appreciate with a lot of the cyberpunk writers is they actually did research.
Yeah, they took the time to do most of the books that are generally beloved are generally far deeper than one would think at a surface glance. And this is one of them. Before it gets into the first adventure, it does have a, you know, the typical, like, this is how your players start, like, how to gather them together, how to hire them for the job, transporting them to New York where the game starts.
Yep.
It does have kind of that session zero or 0.5 vibe to get everybody in line and on the same page.
Yep. And then you have segment one, which every segment is chopped up into different units. Each one could have anywhere from 2 to 4 units within it. But the first chapter, Broadway Swing, each of the chapters or segments have a full page piece of art, which all of them are spectacular.
Yeah, there's no bad art in this book. This book, in fact, has some of the most consistent art in the entire franchise. It's up there with like Night City in that regard, where you're not going to look at an image and be disappointed.
Yep. So this chapter has 3 units, and each of these units will also have episodes. So the whole game is broken down pretty dense hierarchy. Each chapter you're going to get this segment, kind of a synopsis of the segment, and a brief overview of each of the units. It does not give you an overview of the various episodes, and also gives you a list of the NPCs you'll eventually find. So, episode one is basically the pitch. As always, a fixer approaches the party, has a job for them, and tries to recruit them. Which is basically a extraction job for the party to go and grab somebody. The cost, which is 5,000 EB, which is pretty good, but eventually I question that number. And they're also given kind of a cred chip as well to cover any outstanding expenses, but there is a limit to that.
Yeah.
And Momos tries to cover any of the questions the players are going to ask, any reasons why certain answers are going to be given to the players, and kind of he tries to give you a plan for each answer or option that the players give, which some of these chapters get really big because he's trying to cover as much as he can, or at least how he thinks the players are going to behave.
Yeah. Obviously they can't cover every situation, but they give you enough here to act as a guideline so that when you are running and these questions and these scenarios do come up where people kind of want to, you know, go off script a bit, you've got answers. You've got the guidelines for how to handle that, even if it's not specific. Yep. Obviously, it's better if I would strongly suggest running this game with an established group, people who have played together, preferably with characters that are established. You're going to want people who already understand how to play when you're playing this game. There are, of course, many people want to run it as somebody's first experience, and there's nothing wrong with that. I just think it plays out better if people are familiar with the game and the genre and their characters before they go on this giant epic campaign. That's a personal thing.
Yeah. And I don't... I think you're going to get a lot of different outcomes, especially if you know your players, because when we do get to the ending, there are some kind of very disappointing things that can happen to the players, which might give a sour taste to the whole adventure from a player side.
You know, if you've played Cyberpunk 2077, let's just say thematically it's right in
yep.
there.
Agreed. So the players are given the pitch. Of course, they're going to take the adventure and embark. They basically have to extract this scientist from a place called Norcross facility. They have a warehouse, which is actually a R&D facility. So they're basically presented with two options: either grab her in the facility itself, which means they do a B&E to do the extraction, or there's going to be a convoy with her, and that is the only time they can get her when she's in New York City. So they have to do one or the other, and I think that there's a time limit of 4 days, if I recall correctly, in which they have to act.
Yeah, I mean, we mentioned the props earlier, but props are already started filtering into the game. Like, you're given the fixer who sets all this up. His name is Elliot Weir. And like, there's his business card. Like, how cool is that? The cred chip. Tickets for the aircraft. Like, it's... I love the props. Like, Jesus.
Reminds me of a Cthulhu game. Or a Cthulhu box set. And how many props...
Yeah, or like some of those early, like... Advanced Dungeons and Dragons box sets where they just vomited goodness at you.
Yeah, but they didn't really have props like this game in Call of Cthulhu would.
Oh, I remember. I can't remember the name of it, but I had one that literally had like a papercraft mansion that you built that it was haunted and it had floors and stuff. Like, I don't...
Maybe I don't remember that one. It might have been in the later days of... Maybe it was in second edition.
It was... I came across it around 92, 93.
Right. So that would have been second edition.
And it was an incomplete box set. Otherwise, I would have bought it. But, yeah, I mean... Like, Underground did kind of a similar thing where it just... A lot of props and paper stuff, but... This campaign, cat. Sorry about that, people. My cat is throwing a fit.
He's fine. Trust me, my cat throws fits too. so those are the two options, right? Is to attack the convoy or attack the facility. The facility is fleshed out, which also includes the data fort for it. The one. criticism I have around this is that all the maps, whether it's the data fort maps or the facility maps, are all at the end of the segment, not at the end of the episode or at the end of the unit. So you kind of have to either do a, you know, print out those maps beforehand, or basically print them out so that way you have them handy, because you will do a lot of flipping through the book or scrolling. Those maps are not their own little booklet in the box set, at least not that I recall. I don't have the box set in front of me right now, but and I probably should.
I mean, they're old school RPG maps, so they're usually just a basic layout on a, like a little square in the corner of the page. It's not like the battle maps that we're used to today.
Well, they some of the maps in this are they are a lot more detailed than some of the other Altarsarian maps.
Absolutely. So some of them are really detailed. And on the back side of the map, that's on the back side of the map of the USA that the box set comes with, is in fact a giant battle map that is super detailed like that. But for the most part, like our Altarsarian games maps, they're visual representations, because most of the time most games back then were just theater of the mind stuff. Using miniatures for absolutely everything didn't really become a thing until D&D 3.0, as far as a mainstream practice.
Yep.
But for theater of the mind, they're more than adequate.
Yeah, I just went and grabbed a box set. I'm pulling out all the little things, yeah. And they're pretty good quality business cards, too.
Yeah, like nothing in this book, in this box set, is cheap.
Yep. The one thing they do have is they have, like, it's not necessarily cardboard, but it's a thicker type of paper in which they actually have paper representation of the various vehicles you might encounter or need to use during an encounter if you do use maps.
Yeah, absolutely. And like miniature scaled templates for cars, boats, trucks. I would have liked to have seen one, like a full size one for the airship. That's that's just me.
Yes, and if you're, this is the only supplement that I think has a map of an airship.
It is.
So, again, some more stuff to, for reasons why you should try to pick up this is because of just the maps. So, anyways, so the warehouse that you're supposed to attack is, again, not a warehouse. It is an actual R&D facility that the team has to go in and infiltrate. And it is a multi-level floor. Oh, I thought it went down into the basement, but I guess not. I think it's a three-story building. And a pretty detailed map. Question is, do they have bathrooms on floors? Because that's always
the question. Yes, they do, in fact.
Only
a little toilet there in the warehouse.
Yeah.
And not some a toilets lot. On the main cloning lab. Yeah, no, I would hate to work there. Jesus.
They got their own gym.
They do have their own gym.
One benefit, right? So so again, players' options on how they want to approach that. The adventure gives you both on ways of dealing with it and how to treat each area. Again, they stat out pretty much everyone, even some of the NPCs, and you gotta love cyber dogs are at the facility. So, in my opinion, I think that the convoy is the quickest way to get it. But there's always that risk that you might damage the goods. So once
again, I'm a classic, you know, heist extraction type of guy. So I was all about raiding the warehouse.
Yep. So once they get Adriana, who is the clone. Sorry if I'm spoiling it. Next step is to get her out of town. So, Weir, the fixer, does arrange for some travel to get you guys to get the team to Night City through an airship. They also give you a little bit of a chapter on disguising.
Yeah.
Adriana, so that way she doesn't get seen or quickly flagged. Granted, she is going to be kind of unwilling to do that. Mainly because people, you know, don't like to have their looks changed on who they were.
Yeah. I mean, she's definitely not into any permanent change.
Yes. So, your players are, you know, a little bit of role playing there to convince her to do it. But once you get that done, then I think it's a one day and you're on the airship, which is basically going to supposedly take you all the way to Night City. Like most adventures within the day, there are random encounter tables, including on the airship. So, if you're a fan of random encounters, there are charts. I like how there's a possibility that you might meet an old friend or an old enemy from your life path.
Just randomly cruising along.
Which to me always gives a nice flavor to a cyberpunk game when you start pulling from people's life paths. It gives you a breakdown of what the players can do while they're on the airship. And you are actually going to get pretty darn far on the airship, in my opinion, because you are getting out of New York, headed through Pennsylvania, and you're getting all the way to Nashville before something actually happens. During that time, the adventure gives you an optional encounter on board, which is basically a ninja, aka a corporate operative, who is been hired to track her down at a last minute notice. And for whatever reason, he's done some investigation on board and figured out where the clone is and will try to defeat the party if possible. Again, as a GM, you do not necessarily have to include this particular option, but it is there if you are interested.
Yeah, I mean, you can stretch. The times I ran it, there was enough there for me to stretch each segment into its own session.
Yep.
If you're running on a tighter schedule, you could probably knock down each chapter or unit to its own segment. My groups tended to play long and late, so there was always plenty of time to have stuff just randomly pop up.
Yeah. And I think the other thing is, you know, yes, know your party and know how long it's going to take. Again, this whole campaign could end very quickly, right? Depending upon what the players decide to do. So keep that in mind. Right. So outside of Nashville, or right near Nashville, spoiler alert, Norcross has tracked them down. And then in here, you actually kind of learn who Norcross is and being funded by. So Norcross hired some mercenaries to basically shoot down the airship and capture the clone. So there is a bit of a discussion on how the attack happens, and what could possibly happen to the characters while the ship is crashing.
I gotta say, this is the whole airship portion is one of my favorite parts of the whole campaign. Like, it goes from luxurious and calm and peaceful to holy shit, the sky is falling in the space of a snap of the finger. And it becomes really harrowing.
Yep. Yeah. So there's a lot of tension that you can build up in here. Granted, the players are not going to be able to stop the attack or fight back, at least at this point. The AVs that are the attack AVs will be destroyed by the airship's own defense. So there's always that drama that you can play up to. The other thing, of course, it is cyberpunk. So the other thing with this is there's a chance that your characters, or the players' characters, can die just by a dice roll. You might want to change that. Either have them do a luck roll or some other thing to help prevent that from happening. So just keep that in mind, that you're coming from a different generation of gaming, which, you know, players' death were easy come, easy go. However,
which again is why I strongly suggest playing with characters or with people who know how to play the game and are familiar with their characters. It just it'll give them more incentive to keep their schmucks alive.
Yeah. I think the one drawback to this campaign is trying to get new characters into it. So if a character does die, how to get a new player in. Or get a new character in, because I think the party is going to be, especially after this event, they're going to be very paranoid.
That is true.
So, in order to compensate that, I would say have the new character that gets in either be an old friend from a character's life path, or a relative.
At least at this stage. Further on in the game, there are some other options you're going to have.
Yes.
But at this stage, that's the best advice you can give.
Yep. So if the players get killed during the crash or the fall of the airship, that is one option. So with the airship crashing, there is going to be, the players are going to be able to get out and escape the crash. However, there is going to be squads of the mercenaries coming to see what happened. And here is where the CPS value comes in. So the CPS value for this encounter is going to be times 5 the players. So if there's 4 players, there's going to be 20 soldiers. As well, and for each of the 10 soldiers, there's going to be an AV4.
Yeah, and like the players aren't really meant to fight their way out of this as much as they are, like, in terms of fighting to defeat the enemy as much as they are fighting to just get the hell out.
Yep.
This is very much meant to be run in a frantic, fast-paced manner, where the characters, like, flames are all around them. Guys are coming out of the woodwork. It's very much a just get out as quickly and safely as possible.
Yep. And William Moss actually talks about how if the players are able to steal one of the AVs that land. So that's, he kind of thinks like of all the various options that the players will try. To note that they are within 30 miles of Nashville, which will lead into the next episode, which is the third episode. So of this unit, and with Nashville, William Moss actually goes into why would they head to Nashville, right? And gives them some suggestions on how they're going to get there by either stealing some vehicles, and also why would they go there. So there is the option that one of the rocker boys, if the players are playing a rocker boy, that they might know somebody in Nashville, because Nashville is still a music hub of North America. You could also have a fixer.
Really? Go ahead. Yeah. I was going to say, in 2020, Cyberpunk 2020, Nashville is the music hub. That's basically where everything happens.
So, rocker boy might have a contact. Fixer probably will know somebody who knows somebody. And there's other options on how you can tie in at least somebody knowing somebody within Nashville. And that somebody is actually going to be a specific NPC. If they do call Weir, so if they don't, if they decide, hey, we're going to call Weir, Weir will actually set them up with a contact within Nashville as well. So,
and this is one of those situations where if one of the players dies, or one of the characters dies, Weir can set them up with a replacement.
Exactly. And again, Ed Moss goes into, hey, if the players aren't going to call Weir, they have a contact. If they do call Weir, this is how Weir's going to give them an approach. And of course, the NPC in question is Perry Garcia. I don't know who he's it's referring.
Yeah, no, that's such a mystery. Who could Perry Garcia be? Yeah. I love Will Moss. He loves throwing those references out there.
Yep. So they get to Nashville. They get to hang out for a bit, take a breather, try to get an overview, most likely get in contact with Weir. So Weir can tell them, hey, you know, you need to still get into Night City, and Weir is going to try to give them the next kind of waypoint to get to, which will be Memphis. So during their stay in Nashville, another optional encounter is provided, which is the Citizens for Decency, a.k.a. the Inquisitors. A.k.a.
The Inquisitors, yeah. Mixed with the KKK.
Yeah. So if the characters are roaming around Nashville, they have a chance of encountering these hoodlums, and a fight can break out, and the players can have some action around it. So that finishes that unit, which was Unit 2. Next unit, which is Memphis, which contains, I believe, 3 episodes, maybe 2. Actually, it just contains 1 episode.
Yeah, it's just the 1.
Which is Memphis.
Yeah, this... Yeah, I'm going to preface this one personally, this is my least favorite part of the book. Just because...
Not a fan of the king?
I hate Elvis. I just despise him. But that's the only complaint I can make, is I just don't like Elvis. Like, the actual adventure that it's centered around is great. Like, I just don't like Elvis.
Well, maybe you can do, I don't know. I'm trying to think who else could be, the mega pop star.
I mean, Elvis absolutely works for this. They're in Memphis. They hang out at Graceland. They're an Elvis poser gang. Like, it absolutely works 100%. I just had a player who insisted on playing Elvis music because he saw that that's what should happen. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, just personal distaste.
Right.
But yeah, I actually love this section of the adventure. I just, that one little bitty bit.
So, good old Perry is going to be able to drive you to Memphis, where Weir is going to arrange for you to get more transport so he can get to Night City. So the road to Memphis is not too difficult. I think there is, right in the river, it's the first chapter that does not have a encounter table for the trip. So, obviously, you're going to have an uneventful trip to Memphis, which isn't too bad. However,
after everything they just went through, they need to catch their breath somehow.
Yes. Once you do get to Memphis, this is where the players are going to become even more paranoid, because if they try to contact Weir, the phone's going to be answered by someone different, and that person who is different is not friendly to them. So more than likely, the players are going to hang up on that individual. If they're smart. If they're not, then this is where you have to go off script and come up with a something on how
an encounter.
To check the players. Yeah,
something bad happens.
Right.
Yeah. If they're not smart enough to hang that phone up, they get traced.
So the next part of this episode is the Kings, or the Elvises. So, as you well are aware, the Elvises is the biggest poser gang within Memphis, and they are going to attempt to kidnap Adriana, which it seems like they could possibly do it. I would definitely not try to kill the characters. I would try to subdue the characters just to get her kidnapped. Just so you can have the players raid Graceland. Because that would be fun. So, the leader of the poser gangs is in Graceland. And if the players do infiltrate Graceland, the king, as I think he's called, is actually going to respect the players for their attempt to raid the Elvises and give her back and kind of let them go on their way. He will give them some information about it, and but he's kind of an interesting character just because he's not the outright, I'm going to kill you, that I think a lot of GMs portray NPCs are, right? Which, to me, kind of gives players hope that not all NPCs are going to try to kill you, you know? Which I think is what Will Moss was doing. So, You got anything to add with about that?
I mean, the players will likely find some stuff out that's important in this section, especially with the confrontations with the Elvises. And it'll lead to some pretty big questions as well. Like, the truth about Adriana at this point in the game isn't really known, but clues are starting to come out.
Yep. Yeah, that's the other thing. They haven't been told that she is a clone yet. So, the king actually has a photo of her, but it's the actual person that she was cloned from. And the picture is of her older. So, that, I think, is the first clue. Now, if the players have disguised her, why would the Elvises be going after somebody who doesn't look like her anymore? You know?
Yeah.
So that's one.
The other big problem is, like, there's a large confrontation that can happen at Graceland, and they've provided a map of Graceland and floor plans for the building, but man, that is not Graceland.
Yeah.
Most importantly, missing is the guitar-shaped pool, which is kind of a weird omission. Like, if they're going to Graceland, there needs to be the guitar-shaped pool.
Well, I guess Mr. Moss didn't do all his research.
Oh, he didn't. I don't think Moss did the graphic for this. I don't know exactly who did, but yeah.
Well, the old Graceland might have been destroyed during the collapse, you know?
That's very true. It could be a new Graceland. They could have just said, you know what? The rest of the mansion is tacky enough. Let's not do the guitar-shaped pool. It's
possible. Right. So that ends this chapter. So it kind of leaves off at a cliffhanger of where is no longer available and the players have no places to go except on how to get to Night City.
They are on their own from this point.
Yep.
Like, the contract is still good as far as they know. If they want to get paid, they still got to get Adriana to Night City. But their personal support, aka Weir, is no longer available.
And this is also where the campaign starts going in different threads, and how the players approach on what their next steps are, and who and where or who they start working with. The next segment is called Country Breakdown, in which the players are now on their own. So again, this particular segment has two units. Again, each unit is broken up into episodes, and the first episode is a new patron, right? So this is where a new fixer is going to reach out to them. He is a friend of Weir's, and he has been contacted by Weir to help the players. However, you're going to learn in spoilers, so all the players who are listening, shut up, leave. Weir is actually working for someone else, and not the the new fixer is Hart, and Hart is working for someone else, and not necessarily Weir. And this is where the beginning of the chapter goes into who Michael Hart is, and what his motivations are, and trying to get work with the team and embed himself in the team. He is trying to get them out of Memphis, so that is one good thing about him. However, his agenda is not necessarily what the agenda of Weir was. And I don't think we talked about what Weir, whose Weir client was, but I guess at this point we can do a little bit of a spoiler. Weir's client is Adriana's father, who is still working for Norcross. But he is trying to basically get her out of prison, basically in slavery.
Yeah, he's trying to get her extracted to someplace safe where she's not going to be just a medical experiment, just property for Norcross.
Yep.
Or the larger evil behind Norcross.
Yep.
I like Hart as a character. I I do. I liked Weird as well.
Yep.
Their images might have a lot to do with that. They're very archetypical cyberpunk. All the images are so good.
The trench coat with the turned up collar.
Yeah, the shades with the ponytail and the giant oversized 80s or 90s cell phone. But yeah, he just radiates cool.
Yep. The next episode within this unit is confronting Adriana and who she is. Now, this is where it kind of goes a little against the normal cyberpunk rules, in that Adriana has a data fort in her head. And it's a pretty damn big one, too.
Yeah, it's not small.
I think four CPUs. Sorry, six CPUs. So she has an AI in her head, which is technically her old self, or the person she was cloned from, with all those memories. So this chapter is basically convincing the Netrunner within the group, and I highly doubt this chapter is going to be used, because no referee allows a group to have a player run a Netrunner. At least 95% of the people who say, hey, how do you do Netrunning in Cyberpunk, and the 99% of the answers are always, you don't. They're for NPCs.
I mean, we did in my game, but it was very quickly after this campaign ended that it was just decided that it's too much work. It's just too much hassle to try and run a Netrunner. The rules are too inconsistent with whatever's going on, and they just, Netrunning itself takes up too much of the game time.
Yep. Well, I think in here, Will Moss kind of does sort of an abstract way of approaching the Netrunner, and basically requiring programming roles and interface roles, as opposed to, here's your map, move your token on the map, right? You get to here, do this. So I think Moss understood that there was problems with Netrunning and tried to bake into at least the sections he has to move the play along. So, however you get your players to do it, they're going to have to get into her mind and basically find out all the information. And this is where you learn that Norcross is actually a segment of Biotechnica, which, by the way, is also mentioned at the beginning of this book, And of course, in the chapter, they claim that Biotechnica is one of the most evilest corporations in the world, which is contradictory to what other people say Biotechnica, in that Biotechnica is,
I mean,
is not, it's not necessarily they're not evil. They're just better than the rest.
See, and I've never seen them that way. I've always seen them as the in-game equivalent to somebody like Monsanto.
Yeah.
where they're just, they're evil, but they're necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we need the food they provide, but Jesus Christ, are they slimy in how they do it?
Yeah.
Or in Biotechnica's case, we need the medical research that they perform, but man, they're bad. Like, to me, they're worse than Arisaka or Militech by far, because they just operate on that different scale. They know we need them.
So they learn the plans. They also have documentation of how the clone was created, the whole operations around that. So now they have all of that plus the clone. And then the question that William Moss poses is, okay, what do the players do with this information? And he actually breaks it down into kind of a few thoughts of what the players will do, right? Sell her back to Biotechnica, sell her to the highest bidder on the open market, contact the media and try to bust open the story of this illegal cloning. And that's if they go down the media way, that actually helps in further chapters. But we'll talk about that later on. So now the players have a choice to continue on with the mission, or are they greedy and are going to try to sell her out? And that's where I think some interesting role-playing is going. And I think this is where basically the campaign could possibly end very quickly. If the players are the greedy type and just either sell her back to Biotechnica, they can. however, Biotechnica will attempt to kill all the players because they don't want any loose ends. If they try to offload her on the open market, again, those corporations might not want loose ends and attempt to kill the players, which means the players are going to be hunted. If they do the media route, like I said, there is kind of a plan forward for that, turning her over to the media.
The whole book, like the whole campaign, really kind of encourages personal interactions with Adriana as well as the other NPCs, but they really want characters to feel a sense of connection to her.
Yeah.
And they're hoping the book hopes that players have at least some sense of altruism.
Yep.
That they're not just pure greed mongers. But that, you know, some part of them actually cares about what's going on in the world.
And that is going to be kind of up to the referee. So the referee is really going to need to play her and do a lot of role-playing with her to kind of endear her to the other players. There's actually going to be some interesting options later on when it comes to Adriana and interactions with the players, but that's in an upcoming chapter. But yeah, so there has to be a way in which you guys or the referee really gives her some quirkiness or something that players are going to attach to her so that they actually care about what happens to her. They also, you know, during the breakdown, you know, or when that data dump happens, the player should understand that if she goes back to Biotechnica, she is not going to live. They are going to cut her up, which is part of that procedural notes that is downloaded from her head.
It is 100% an ET phone home situation, guys.
Yeah. So I would say as soon as she gets extracted, start role playing her to get herself endeared into the players group.
Yeah.
And make her well liked, which it's a skill. And you got to know your players to know what kind of NPC they will kind of latch on to.
And it helps if you, I'm not going to tell you to, you know, metagame, but it helps if, you know, at the end of every gaming session or at the beginning of the next one, you kind of throw in, you know, how close she's growing to you or some hint that they should, if they're not taking the hint already, they should have some sort of bond with this young woman.
Yeah. I think it would have. And see, the problem is like how she interacts with the players later on. This isn't conducive to this, but I mean, one option would be to make her younger, right? Like a tween. Which should make the players more protective of her. However, like I said, there's some situations later on that is not conducive.
Yeah, I would option. I personally would not recommend making her younger because of those situations that are going to arise later.
Yep. And actually, this is one of the side notes of her stray thoughts when they're digging around in her brain is she thinks one of the player's characters is cute.
I mean, I would personally run her as not being younger, but being very naive. Like she hasn't spent any time outside the lab. That's been her whole world. Her interactions with people, like she'll have she has memories of. Vague memories of her former life before she was cloned due to implanted memories, but nothing real. Yeah. Like, so these are her first true friends. It's her first time outside of a lab situation. And I would play up on that. I would play up on vulnerability and curiosity, things of that nature, those character traits.
So the next episode is how the players are going to get out of Memphis. So the suggestion is, at least from Hart, the fixer, he is giving them a call from New Orleans, and he wants them to come to New Orleans to help him out. And he gives reasons why the players should head down to New Orleans. Granted, it's not a straight route to Night City, but that's one of the reasons why he says to do it, right?
Because it's a bonus. That's they're watching those paths and the party like breaking off and going off in a different direction, and we'll throw the scent off.
Yep. And even in the media choice, they contact a media. That media is also going to direct them down to New Orleans as well. So, as I said in the beginning, this is kind of railroady. But as a referee, you want to try to make them think this is the right course of action, and they're making that choice.
Yeah, Hart will... Hart will book passage for them, or at least arrange passage for them on a smuggler's vessel. If you go through the book as written, it's going to be manned by a father and daughter team, who, again, I love the NPCs in this book. They're both, for as short a role as they play, they're very fleshed out. they're people I would drop into any game. They're just good NPCs. And nobody in this game has weird names. They've all got normal names, and some of them have handles. But, like, these two are Cleary and Grace Cantner. Like, just normal, like, non-ridiculous names.
Yep.
And I appreciate that. Thank you.
There is a map of the boat. So, if you do an encounter, you kind of have a quick little map that you can use. And basically, it's a river trip. And during that river trip, of course, there are another encounter table that you can use for all the various river encounters. Or you can just pick which ones you want, right? So,
yeah,
the encounters include a militia.
They're all cool. Throw it all at them.
Yeah.
It'll be a really eventful trip down that river.
So, there's the militia. There are the corporate militia. There are pirates. Everyone loves a good river pirate. Another nomad family, which could be useful, especially if one of the players is a nomad. Kind of help the nomads if they're looking for another way out, right? Giving contacts to their next leg, which is going to be, once they get to New Orleans, they are actually going to be taking a bit of a detour into more water. So there's that interaction you can do. And then there's storms, which I think not often in Cyberpunk you're encountering weather.
Yeah. Which is really weird to me, because I think weather would play such an important role. Especially since they're just the most cliche aspect of the genre is that it just rains all the time. But I mean, sure. Throw some lightning, throw some inclement weather. Like, I don't necessarily follow the sentiment that it's raining all the time, but weather can be its own character. It can certainly be its own challenge.
Yep. Yeah, so the encounter table is basically, you know, roll three times for the 4-day journey. Or, like I said, you can pick whichever ones you want. And if you want to delay them even more, add another encounter. And also come up with your own. However, there are two optional encounters that are presented. I'm surprised they just didn't mix them into the whole encounter table. One is called the Hot Doggers, which are basically a bunch of spoiled brats kind of cruising the river. And basically, it's just a short encounter with...
Just a short encounter. Yeah.
And then the next one is working with some eco-terrorists who kind of would hire the players to help them... destroy a facility. So, and of course, the owner of the boat, Cleary, is working with these guys. So he kind of asked the players as well.
I mean, they're all about preserving the river, which is where Cleary and Grace make their entire living from. So yeah, they're definitely allies. And for an optional mission, it's pretty fleshed out. It's significant.
Yep, and there is a map associated with it. So, and I think there is a data map as well. So you have a full facility.
You've got to hack into her brain.
And then basically that ends this chapter. And the next chapter, you're going to be getting into New Orleans. 8:30. New Orleans is kind of a big chapter.
We can save this till next episode. I know you got some important stuff to take care of tomorrow.
Yes, my wife is going in for knee surgery. It shouldn't be a big deal, and it's a good thing. So she's already had one done last year. It went successfully. Oh. I'm confident this is one that's going to go just as well. So, however,
she will absolutely be in my thoughts, and
well, I appreciate that, man.
As well as some small amount of jealousy for her getting cybernetics.
Yes, she's not. I'm sure
she doesn't see it that way, but
she actually does. She's like,
I love your wife.
Yeah, she snubs her nose at me by saying, "Oh, I'm more of a cyberpunk than you. I got cybernetics."
Oh, I absolutely love your wife. Like, I have never spoken a single word to her, but you tell her that I love her. She's amazing.
Yeah. So.
And I agree. She's beating us both.
Just tell me about it. I'm just waiting to plug or get Elon's neural implant. Although
I
wouldn't trust it either. That's the other problem. I love the concept, but I don't trust the person who's making it.
Yeah, not from him. Like, he's not making anything. He's just taking credit for other people's work. But with the track record of their products lately, I wouldn't let that thing get anywhere near me.
Yeah.
Somebody else maybe.
So next time we'll continue this probably in two episodes. Next episode we do have another guest.
Next episode we have a guest, and then we'll pick this back up the episode after that.
Yep.
So the next episode will be the 20th.
Next episode is the 20th, yes.
So we will pick up the second half of this review
on the 3rd.
On the 3rd
would be the soonest, unless we get another guest.
Unless we get another guest, which is always a possibility.
So,
but yeah, we knew going into this that this was at least going to be a two episode job. Yeah. This campaign is huge, and there's so many little fiddling details that we want to talk about with all of it.
Exactly.
This and Night City are my two favorite books as far as art goes, and I never get tired of looking at these images. But yeah, we will continue this review in 2 weeks. Hopefully your wife will have recovered by then and can give you one of those super powered kicks to the butt. All right.
So thank you for all who stayed on and listened to us, and those who are going to be listening to us in the future. We also want to thank Robert Mulligan for hosting us on Cyber Nation Uncensored yet again for our 61st episode. I am Cyber Smiley. I have a site called cybersmiley.net. It's chock full of little utilities to use for your Cyberpunk 2020 and Cyberpunk Red games. I float about Discord as well as Reddit, which I do jump into conversations now and then. I'm in quite a lot of Discord servers that are around Cyberpunk, which I am grateful that there's that many, but it's also hard to keep up with all of them.
It is. It's like back in the day with Yahoo groups.
Yeah. I also have my own Discord server, which you can join through my site. And there we talk about various topics on various Cyberpunk properties. So that's it for me.
I am Derek Bernier, a.k.a. Wisdom000. I run DataFortress2020.com, the largest, most comprehensive site for Cyberpunk 2020 materials out there. I can be found on Facebook, where I also moderate, administrate for the Data Fortress 2020 group, as well as the Cyberpunk 2020 group. Like Will, I'm on Reddit, where I, you know, lurk and jump in every now and then, same with Discord, And as always, you can get us through our websites. By all means, if you have any comments, complaints, suggestions, criticisms, anything, please reach out to us. We love to hear from you. He already thanked Cybernation Uncensored. So I will just say thank you to all of you for joining us, and we will see you in 2 weeks.
Ta-ta for now.
Cybernation Uncensored.